and Ray Scott Lester. Mr. Wallace.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. As the court knows, I represent the appellant, cross-appellee Scott Lester, in this matter. In this case, is before the court pursuant to a judgment of non-dischargeability entered by the Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of Illinois. Judge Fine is presiding. The court found four specific instances in which it determined that my client committed fraud on Heptacor. It declined to find all of my client's indebtedness to Heptacor non-dischargeable. What's sorely lacking in the Bankruptcy Court's findings is a finding that my client intended to defraud Heptacor.
At what stage?
At any stage.
Okay.
Your Honor, there is not one finding, not one statement in the Bankruptcy Court's opinion that Scott Lester intended to defraud Heptacor. And as this court made clear in the McClellan case, intent is a linchpin of the 523A2A determination of non-dischargeability. Now, Heptacor would state that there needn't be a finding of intent or finding of fact pursuant to Bankruptcy Rule 7052, and it cites the Fossum case from the Eighth Circuit. However, Fossum is distinct in that in Fossum, there was a proxy for a finding under Section 1112B of the Bankruptcy Code, which justified dismissal of a Chapter 11 case. That proxy was substantially identical to the cause for dismissal that is required under Section 1112B. There is no such proxy in the Bankruptcy Court's opinion here, none whatsoever. Without intent, a debt can't be determined to be non-dischargeable. In addition, even if the court were to find that there were sufficient statements in the Bankruptcy Court's opinion that my client intended to deceive or defraud Heptacor, the evidence wouldn't support that determination. This was a factoring relationship that CFM, Cash Flow Management, my client's firm, had with its customers. Heptacor provided funds to CFM. CFM would then factor accounts receivable.
You know, as far as the plaintiff knew, Mr. Lester and Cash Flow Management were operating at arm's length with OHA and IHA, correct?
That is entirely correct, Your Honor. There's no dispute.
Well, then, but wasn't Mr. Lester at the least obliged to disclose his interest in OHA and IHA?
Your Honor, had he done so, we certainly wouldn't be here today. But I submit to the court that that is not critical. Again, CFM was factoring accounts receivable. It factored accounts receivable for OHA and IHA, which were in which Mr. Lester was admittedly a principal. However, you're not depending, when you're factoring accounts receivable, you're not depending upon your customer's creditworthiness. You're depending upon the creditworthiness of your customer's account debtors, because they're the ones who ultimately have to pay the invoices that are factored. Yes, we wouldn't be here today had Mr. Lester disclosed his involvement with OHA and IHA, but I submit to the court that that was not material because, again, you're looking to the account debtors, not necessarily to OHA or IHA, to foot the bill. And again, the Bankruptcy Court, Heptacor has made statements in its brief that, you know, maybe there weren't any accounts receivable. Well, the Bankruptcy Court found there were accounts receivable. It specifically said there were accounts receivable. It called them mislabeled, but it found that there were accounts receivable. Again, the mislabeling, Your Honors, is not material. It doesn't matter. Again, we're depending upon the creditworthiness of the account debtors, and there is not one ounce of proof in the record that Mr. Lester had any indication that any of the receivables that were factored were bogus or uncollectible at the time they were factored. As it turned out, yes, some of them were uncollectible. Some of them may have been bogus, but there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Lester knew that. Unless he knew that, I submit to the court he could not have intended to defraud Heptacor.
In factoring, isn't the value of the purchased debt, or whatever you call it, obligation based on collectability? Did you pay 20% of the value or 80%?
There is a risk component.
Yeah, but isn't that risk vary with each collectible?
It may vary from account debtor to account debtor, the amount that that the factor would advance on a particular account, on a particular receivable, yes, Your Honor.
So there's a lot of variation in how much one would pay for $1,000 obligation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, and I guess the question is for the organizations that he had an interest in, the implication is that perhaps they paid too much to buy those that were not worth anything.
I don't believe, Your Honor, that there's been an allegation that CFM overpaid for any receivables it purchased from either IHA or OHA. I believe the allegation is now on appeal that there were no such receivables and that Mr. Lester should have told Heptacor about his involvement with OHA and IHA, but there's been no allegation that they overpaid.
Oh, I see. The allegation is that they just were phony. There weren't any.
That's correct.
I see.
But there's no evidence in the record to support that. There is evidence in the record, and the bankruptcy court found, in some of the instances that it found Mr. Lester's debt non-dischargeable, that there were receivables. He said they were mislabeled, but he found there were receivables. Didn't find that they were uncollectible or bogus. Without that, Your Honor, I don't know how Mr. Lester could have intended to defraud Heptacor. On the four transactions that the court did find objectionable, the $80,000, what I've called the $80,000 OHA-IHA transactions, there were receivables factored. The $150,000 wind-up payment, there's no representations identified anywhere in the record that Mr. Lester made to Heptacor to induce an advance of $150,000. That money was already in the pot, and Mr. Lester used it to pay bills of CFM, outstanding bills. The $50,000 loan transfer and the $5,000 loan transfer, both of those transactions, there is evidence in the record that there were receivables factored. That money then went out to CFM's customer. Yes, it ultimately found its way to Mr. Lester, but I don't submit to the court that's not really relevant. Again, the question is, were the receivables purchased, and the record says there were. I don't know how Heptacor can now contend that there weren't, because the judgments were taken on many of these outstanding factored receivables. They were assigned to Heptacor. Heptacor even got payment on some of the assigned judgments. So for Heptacor to now contend that that there were no receivables factored or that they were bogus is preposterous.
Well, but if the evidence supports an inference that Mr. Lester was running a shell game here in order to prop up both OHA and IHA, then why wouldn't each of the four transactions that Judge Fine cited, why wouldn't that be a specific instance of fraud?
Again, Your Honor, there's no evidence, first of all, that Mr. Lester was running a shell game. There's no evidence that there were no receivables or that they were bogus or that Mr. Lester knew there were no receivables or knew they were bogus. And without intent, the debt can't be non-dischargeable, and this court has said that. Based upon what's set forth in our brief, Your Honor, and the record, I would ask that the judgment of the district court be reversed and the bankruptcy court be reversed to the extent those courts found that certain of my clients' debts to Heptacor are non-dischargeable and affirmed to the extent that those courts declined to find all of my clients' obligations to Heptacor non-dischargeable. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hodgson?
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Mr. Wallace would have this court believe that all of the transactions between OHA, IHA, CFM, Heptacor, and Mr. Lester were arm's length transactions between the individual companies that were all dealing in their own best interest. And I submit that we should look now at the shell game that he was really playing. Because what in fact happened here was after a period of time of successful factoring, Mr. Luster saw that there was an opportunity to make money on both sides of the transaction. And he became chairman of the board of OHA in November or December of 1995, and he made absolutely no disclosure of that to Heptacor. Now, in addition to that, on January the 17th of 1996, he formed IHA, another company, to do the same kind of work that OHA was doing in Illinois in the state of Missouri. He again makes no disclosure of that to Heptacor. He then, in February, comes to Heptacor and says, can we convert the $500,000 you've already given us to equity and borrow another $1 million? And Heptacor says no, but we will extend an additional $200,000. And by the letter agreement that's in the record, they agreed to allow him to continue to reinvest the funds that had already been loaned and to loan another $200,000. Now, that was with the clear understanding, as Mr. Drury testified, that the money was going to actually factor accounts receivables of independent third parties, and that was not the case. And as Judge Fines found, and I submit to this court that his rulings on the facts are not clearly erroneous, which is the test to be applied here, at that point, Mr. Luster had an obligation to disclose his personal interest in these companies. And by not doing so, the fraud occurred at that point. Now, that is particularly bolstered by the fact that Mr. Luster admits that OHA was nothing but a loose group of guys that met once. There were no stock certificates, there were no minutes, there were no meetings. In fact, I submit to this court that there was no corporation other than in name.
Mr. Hawkins, if I understand how the purported transfer of $80,000 in accounts receivable from OHA to IHA furthered the alleged scheme here, but help me to understand how that transaction in and of itself defrauded Heptacor. In other words, what was it about that specific transaction that amounted to a fraudulent misrepresentation to Heptacor for the purposes of Section 523A2A.
And you're speaking of the $80,000 transfer?
$80,000. Well, I understand how. Yes. Okay.
Okay. What was done in that transaction was OHA accounts receivable were taken and were labeled as IHA accounts receivable. Now, in fact, in that point of time, IHA had no business activity. It had no receivables. Those receivables were then supposedly used as collateral for the $80,000 advance. The lie in that transaction is that IHA has receivables. The lie in that transaction even further is that IHA is even a valid corporation, because IHA was nothing more than a piece of paper from the Secretary of State of the state of Missouri.
And that's how that and the $5,000 check to Rate Search
the $5,000 was the second transaction.
Yeah.
There were two transactions. There was one for $80,000, which I've just described.
Right.
There was another one for $50,000, where what they did, they sent a request.
See, I just want to know how we fit both of those into the terms of the statute.
They were fraud for several reasons. As I said, in the $80,000, they failed to disclose that, in fact, IHA was not an operating company. They failed to disclose that this $80,000 wasn't, in fact, going to be used by an independent third party to factor accounts receivable, but was instead used as the venture capital to start IHA's operations. Now, Mr. Luster would say, well, but we can't control what a company does once with the money, once the account is factored. And if we were dealing with independent third parties, I would agree with that assessment. But we're not. All OHA, IHA, and CFM were all the alter egos of Mr. Luster. And he used this scheme for no other reason than to get the money to buy to set up IHA and to buy OHA, because if you will recall, the $50,000 advance was then transferred from CFM to OHA, and then the next day OHA transferred that money to Mr. Lester's personal account, and then that same day Mr. Lester took that $50,000 and paid it to Mr. Greenwell as the down payment on his purchase for OHA. Mr. Lester knew that the request for funding on both the $80,000 and the $50,000, and in fact the entire transaction, were not being used by independent third parties to factor accounts receivable. They were being used for him to acquire and set up these companies.
Now, this, you described, I think, in your brief as sort of a venture capital thing that was unauthorized.
Yes.
Was there part of this scheme, at least, where somehow that money was going to come back after these companies were profitable, or was it a one-way street?
I can't answer that because it never got that far, but my guess would be it's analogous to someone who is an embezzler. Most embezzlers take the money because they have an immediate emergency and they think, I will be able to put it back before anybody ever knows. And I think that's what happened here, is Mr. Lester, quite frankly, got greedy. He thought he could buy OHA and set up IHA and use Heptacor's money to do so. And he thought he could make so much money that he would pay all of that line of credit back and nobody would ever know the difference. But it didn't work out that way. And Mr. Wallace wants to talk about, we're saying that there were no accounts receivable. We're not saying that there were no accounts receivable, but we are saying the same thing that Judge Fines found in his order, and that was there was no evidence to substantiate that accounts receivable went bad with OHA and IHA. We don't know where that money went. And when we had presented the evidence about the money having gone out, we believe, under the rule, the bankruptcy rule, that the burden of proof shifted to Mr. Lester to come in with the invoices and show us where that money went. And he never did so at any stage of the proceedings. We could never find out where that money went. And by setting up this entire scheme, we believe that all of the money that he acquired as part of that scheme, through the additional advancement of the $200,000 and the continued reinvestment of the money, is non-dischargeable. Now, Lester's attorney wants to talk about intent, and I would ask the court to recall what he said just a second ago. His first presentation about intent wasn't that there was no evidence about intent. It was that Judge Fines made no specific finding on intent. And I submit to the court, Judge Fines made a specific finding of fraud, which included all of the elements. And if there is, in fact, evidence in the record to support the intent, then his finding must be affirmed by this court. And I don't see how you can read the record and not find the intent. You don't buy a corporation with somebody else's money. You don't set up a corporation with somebody else's money. It is unbelievable that Mr. Lester testified at trial that Wayne Drury, after he had been told that the money had disappeared or that the business was going bankrupt, that he would authorize Mr. Lester to spend $150,000 to wind up his business affairs with Heptacor's money. And in fact, Judge Fines found that that was an unbelievable statement, and that Mr. Lester was not credible and Mr. Drury was credible. We have to remember, when we're talking about intent, that this is a man who pays no income taxes because he doesn't believe the government can make him pay income taxes. This is a man who has admitted under his own attorney's direct examination that he had had securities fraud in a previous matter. This is a man who is willing to take the money and do with it as he pleases and then simply say, well, I lost it, I'm sorry, let's all walk away from it.
Now, you said earlier that for a period of time there was successful factoring.
Yes, in 1995, Your Honor.
And I guess you're saying it was after that time that this intent, that in your cross appeal, you want the whole amount. Is the whole amount, does it not include the 95 transaction?
No, the amount that is left owed, the $678,000, includes factoring that was done in 1996, because when the funds things went well in 95. And when the money came back in, then the money was reinvested. And of the $678,000, which is owed, $407,003.40 are accounts receivables of OHA, and $156,694 are receivables of IHA. That totals $563,697.40. And I would submit, if nothing else, that certainly the amounts to OHA and IHA are non-dischargeable, because those two companies were the specific alter egos of Mr. Lester. And under De La Cruz, which you have read, those are a result of the actual fraud directly. And we would ask this court to increase the judgment to include $563,000 and some odd dollars, rather than the $285,000 found by Judge Fines, for that exact reason. It is undisputed that he used Heptacore's money as venture capital to form IHA, and it is undisputed that he used Heptacore's money to make the only payment for his purchase of OHA. And those debts should be non-dischargeable. And that, that, Your Honors, is really the basis of our case. We think that the evidence of intent and fraud is clear and really unquestionable. And we would ask on our cross-appeal that the court increase the judgment from $285,000 to $563,000, which is the amount due by OHA and IHA. And in addition to that, the interest calculations would need to be adjusted based on the exact amount ordered by this court. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wallace.
May it please the court. Your Honors, now I'm confused. A moment ago, counsel stated to the court that we're not contending that there weren't any accounts receivable, we just don't know where the money went. I'm confident that's what counsel represented to the court a moment ago, and Judge Fines did not make any such finding that Mr. Lester can't explain to us where the money went, therefore his obligations, to the extent I've identified, to Heptacore are non-dischargeable. Judge Fines didn't make that determination. Not accounting for where the money went is not a 523 issue, it's a 727 issue. There's no 727 complaint before the bankruptcy court. Your Honor, if there were accounts receivable, then I don't know, and I hate to beat the dead horse, how Mr. Lester defrauded Heptacore, because that's the crux of Heptacore's argument in the courts below, Your Honor, that Mr. Lester wasn't factoring. Judge Fines found that he was indeed factoring. Heptacore told the court now that Mr. Lester was factoring, but he simply can't explain where the money went. Well, that's not an issue. That's not something the bankruptcy court bottomed its decision on. It's not been briefed. It wasn't argued in the court below. And, Your Honor, beyond what counsel asserted today, the record again reflects the fact that there were accounts receivable. With respect to the question of whether Judge Fines made a finding of intent, yes, this court engages in review to determine if the bankruptcy court's findings of fact are clearly erroneous. But on questions of law, this court engages in de novo review. Absent a finding of intent, and in accord with this court's decision in McClellan against Cantrell, how can we determine if Judge Fines applied the appropriate standard if fraud isn't if intent is an essential element of fraud without the finding under Bankruptcy Rule 7052, how do we know what standard Judge Fines applied? And if he applied an inappropriate standard, then again this court has to reverse because he made a mistake. Your Honor, based upon my prior arguments to the court and based upon the briefs, I ask again that the decision below be reversed to the extent Judge Fines found certain of Mr. Lester's obligations to Heptacore non-dischargeable, and affirmed to the extent Judge Fines declined to find all of his obligations to Heptacore non-dischargeable. And I thank the court for its time this morning.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.